This is Age of Treason Radio. With your host, Tan Stoffel. Yaqui on Culture and Race, Part 10. The last time I contrasted some of what Adolf Hitler had written about culture and race with what Yaqui had written on culture and race, and how on the fundamental point of what's more important, the people or the culture, they differ. And I find Hitler's view of it, writing 25 years earlier than Yaqui, more accurate, more compelling, more real, more in touch with reality. Anyway, picking up here with Yaqui on page 74 of Imperium, 274, in a section he titled Race, People, Nation, State. The materialistic race thinking of the 19th century had particularly heavy consequences for Europe when it was coupled with one of the early 20th century movements of resurgence of authority. He's referring here to the rise of National Socialist Germany. And this is where Yaqui puts his erroneous idea about race into, it comes to an erroneous conclusion because of it. He writes, any excrescence of theoretical equipment on a political movement is a luxury, and the Europe of 1933 to 2000 can afford none such. Europe has paid dearly for this romantic concern with old-fashioned racial theories, and they must be destroyed. Yaqui blamed materialistic race thinking for the heavy consequences of the war. Just as the Jews did at the time, and since then, that narrative, their narrative, has become the dominant narrative. This is the way everyone, almost everyone, and certainly the way it's taught in the schools and propagandized in the media, is that the war was Hitler's fault, Nazis' fault, nationalism's fault, Europeans' fault. It's all about transferring blame away from the Jews and even to the victims of the terrible consequences, these heavy consequences Yaqui talks about. Transferring the blame away from the Jews to the victims of those consequences themselves. That it was nationalists and racists that caused that war and caused suffering. And this has been consistent. It probably predates World War II, and it certainly echoes ever since. Yaqui continues, race has two meanings, which will, and by the way, I'm skipping sections here. I'm trying to just clip out the pieces here where he's talking about race. We've finally gotten to the meat of what Yaqui has to say about race. Race has two meanings, which will be taken in order, and then their relative importance in an age of absolute politics will be shown. The first meaning is an objective one, the second subjective. The succession of human generations related by blood have the clear tendency to remain fixed in a landscape. Nomadic tribes wander within larger but equally definite bounds. Within this landscape, the forms of plant and animal life have local characteristics different from transplantations of the same strains and stocks in other landscapes. Right there, he's already giving a preview of the error of his thinking. That, well, I have a lot more to say about this. Let me just keep reading here and we'll get into this. The anthropological studies of the 19th centuries uncovered a mathematically presentable fact which affords a good starting point to show the influence of the soil. It was discovered that for any given inhabited area of the world, there was an average cephalitic index of the population. Cephalic index is the head measurements. I've talked about this before when digging into race science. The ironic thing here is that Yaki earlier in his book, and we discussed this in earlier installments, attacked Darwinism, the idea of evolution by natural selection and adaptation to the environment. He rejected that. And yet here he's talking about how human beings are so plastic and that their cephalic index changes drastically and quickly. Continuing here. It was discovered that for any given inhabited area of the world, there was an average cephalic index of the population. More important, it was learned through measurements on immigrants to America from every part of Europe, and then on their children born in America, that this cephalic index adheres to the soil and immediately makes itself manifest in the new generation. Thus, long-headed Jews from Sicily and short-headed ones from Germany produced offspring with the same average head measurement, the specifically American one. Bodily size and span of growth were two other characteristics in which all types, whatever in America, Indians, Negroes, white men, were found to have the same average, regardless of average size and growth span of the countries or stocks from which they came. What Yaki is referring to here, this fact he calls this scientific fact, is actually Franz Boas's scientific fraud, which I've talked about at length previously. This is, to be charitable to Yaki, this is where he went wrong. He latched on to, and what his motives were for latching on to this and accepting it as fact rather than questioning it, I don't know, but he did, and he used it as a reason to, that Darwin had to be wrong and that race had to be non-biological, it had to be spiritual instead, and everything else that's wrong about his thinking about race is tied to this acceptance of a Jewish fraud about race. But wait, it gets worse. From these and other facts, both comparatively new and of ancient observation, it is apparent that the landscape exerts an influence on the human stocks within its bounds, as well as on the plant and animal life. The technic of this influence is beyond our ken. The source of it, we do know. It's not beyond our ken. It's beyond his ken because he's rejected Darwinism, he's rejected evolution, because he rejects rationalism. But the landscape exerting an influence on the human stocks, as he writes, is really just another way of saying adaptation to environment via the technique of natural selection. That's Darwinism. Now, in the next few paragraphs and pages, most of what he writes is very vague, very irrational, gibberish, if not just total BS. But again, stripping out just the stuff that he has to say about race, he writes on page 276, race in a man is the plane of his being which stands in relationship to plant and animal life, and beyond them, to the great macrocosmic rhythms. It is, so to speak, the part of man that is generalized into, absorbed into the all, capital A, rather than his soul, which defines his species and sets him off from all the other forms of existence. So Yaki saw the soul, this intangible, indescribable thing, as being what set apart man from animal, and he's not alone in that. That's a common religious and especially Christian way of seeing the difference between man and animal. He continues, life manifests itself in the four forms, all capitalized, plant, animal, man, high culture. I would say which of these things is not like the others? A high culture is purely in men's minds. Springs from men, but is not really life. But let's see here how we can reconcile this with other things we've discussed previously, and let me finish this paragraph here. Distinct though each is, yet it is related to all the others. The animals, subject as they are to the soil, retain thus in their being a plane of plant-like existence. Race is the expression of the plant-like and also the animal-like in man. The high culture, being by being fixed for its duration to a landscape, retains also a connection with the plant world, no matter how defiant and free-moving are its proud creations. Its high politics and great wars are an expression of the animal and human, and human in its nature. He, you know, this is one of the problems I've seen recurring in Yaki. He makes these assertions with literally no foundation, no supporting evidence even presented, like he does here, like that the high culture, this capital H, capital C, high culture, is fixed for its duration to a landscape. Why? Who knows? He doesn't even explain. And as I, when I mentioned this and touched on it briefly previously, I said, you know, he doesn't, because he discounts the value of the people themselves, he doesn't see that it somehow springs from the people. In fact, in this paragraph, he's actually denying it. He says no matter how defiant or free moving, no matter how much the people are moving around, the culture seems to stick, which it doesn't really, because it follows the people. It's an expression of the people. My criticism of Yaki, I suppose, could be applied to me, that I'm just asserting things without any support. But it seems far more reasonable to me, the way I see things, than the way Yaki sees things. And maybe that's what it comes down to, is what is more appealing to your sense of reality. Previously, I had discussed these life and the fact that life can be defined as evolution. That what Yaki rejects is actually one way of defining what life actually is, and that the, you know, in his four forms of life, he lists plant, animal, man, and high culture. And the equivalent list would be, in a Darwinian biological way of looking at it, a scientific way of looking at it, is non-life and life. And then amongst life, you can differentiate between the unconscious life, the animals, and conscious life. And even beyond conscious life, a self-directed consciousness. A consciousness which takes teleological control over its own direction. And that's what the discussion of cosmotheism is about, and what Kevin Alfred Strom was getting at in his discussion of what is life and how does it relate to evolution. This idea of self-awareness and consciousness is, I think, the critical thing. Rather than calling it soul and leaving it vague and ill-defined and even attached to a particular religious way of seeing things, consciousness is maybe just as ill-defined, but it's at least something that you can define. And maybe in a future installment, I'll dig deeper into this idea. But I think it's straightforward enough to describe it as animals, for instance, which have very basic emotional states and reactions to things. They don't communicate at a high level. They don't preserve their knowledge from generation to generation, except biologically through inborn instincts. And that's one thing that differentiates them from man. Man writes down his history and tells stories to his progeny and organizes on large scales. And as I've said before, that the advantage that the Jews have is that the big leg up that they seem to have over Europeans, over white people, is their self-awareness, their consciousness of themselves as a people, as a group, with interests, and that those interests are paramount and that they must preserve their group, and that this is what Europeans lack. And it's in part, we lack it because the Jews attack it, because the Jews corrode it, because the Jews try to destroy it whenever we show any signs of consciousness. And that's why you see sometimes people making this metaphorical reference to waking up and awakening other people. This is what consciousness is. They're trying to, they hope, they see some hope in trying to make others conscious of the same things they are, aware of what they are, and aware collectively of our collective interests. that we're related to each other and that we have a common future with each other, and without each other, we don't have a future. That's what I mean by consciousness. One more paragraph here of Yaki. Some of the totality of human characteristics are soil determined, others are stock determined. He's talking there about genes versus environment, nature versus nurture. Pigmentation is one of the latter. Somehow, he says that skin color, which isn't transformed magically by the soil, he acknowledges that that doesn't get transformed by the soil, but with this head stuff, because he was going on Boas's fraud, he believed that Boas's results that he published had said that the skull shape changes, instead of his own believing his own eyes and seeing that Negro African skull shapes hadn't changed in the hundreds of years they had been on North American soil, and that their mentality hasn't changed either, even since Yaki's time. He writes, finishing this paragraph, the most important element also in the objective meaning of race is the spiritual. So there he makes explicit what I've pointed out many times before, that the spiritual is paramount, the spiritual comes first, it's more important than the material, the biological. But it's not true. The physical and mental characteristics are heritable, and the most important aspect of race is actually biological, and that's not just a bald assertion. The fact is that you can change your ideas, you can change your memes in your head, you can change your spirit, but you can't change your genes. The biological part of race is immutable, except by miscegenation or failure to reproduce. He gets into, in the next few paragraphs, the species problem, which I've covered before, and I'll link to it in the program post. The idea that there's fuzzy boundaries between the races of man, and it's hard to categorize men into different races. It's difficult. And he concludes, he says, within wide limits, a primitive population in a landscape has a similar look, but closer scrutiny will be able to find local refinements. And these again will branch down into tribes, clans, families, and finally individuals. Race, in the objective sense, is the spiritual-biological community of a group. Here at least he acknowledges that there's both aspects to race, as I've asserted before myself. It's pretty clear that in order for a race to exist, you need both the biological and you need the people to be conscious of themselves as a race. If they're not conscious of it, they'll lose it. They'll lose the biological integrity, that whatever they biological integrity they have eventually. He writes, thus, races cannot be classified other than arbitrarily. The materialistic 19th century produced several classifications of this arbitrary kind. The only characteristics used were, of course, purely material ones. Thus, skull form was the basis of one, hair and speech type of another, nose shape and pigmentation of another. This was, at best, mere group anatomy, but did not approach race, did not approach his idea of race. And he's, I think, just denying, really, that the race scientists who discussed race did talk about mental characteristics as well as physical characteristics. It wasn't merely group anatomy. It was much of race science, and specifically this cephalic index, was focused on measuring the things that are tangible, things that are easily measured. But the race hygienists working in National Socialist Germany talked about thought patterns and personality traits. And others outside of Germany before and after have also discussed that. So he's really creating a straw man here. He goes on in the subsequent paragraphs to describe biological attributes of race. He talks about smell, and I would add to that pheromones that we know now since, that distinguish between races, or that help, are one way that races can be distinguished. Speech, song, laughter, he mentions, diseases and the resistance to diseases that are characteristic of certain races. And specifically, he talks about Jews here. He says, American medical statistics show that Jews have more nervous disease, more diabetes, and less tuberculosis than the Americans. And that, in fact, the incidence of any one disease shows a different figure for the Jews. So he's noting there the racial distinction between Jews and other Americans. But the face is the great visible sign of race. Back to his general attitude about race now. We do not know what it is that conveys race in the physiognomy, and attempts to reach it by statistics and measurements must fail. No, they don't necessarily fail. In fact, forensic anthropologists are able to determine the race of a skeleton just from looking at the bones in the skeleton. The measurements, the skull shape and size is one, but the other, there are other aspects of skeletons that enable them to tell the difference. And it is by measurements and by statistics that they do this. In fact, all of these things that he's mentioned previously, smell, speech, these biological things, generally come down to statistical bell curve type things. It's not a hard or fast, you either have this trait or you don't if you're a member of a certain race. And this is something that is used to bamboozle people, that to make the argument that race doesn't exist, is they say, well, there's overlap. You can find every attribute in every race. And, you know, I've seen that argument made with blood types. And, it's true on the surface, but what they're obscuring is the fact that there are different concentrations of particular traits within the different races, and they can be distinguished in the same way that other things can be teased apart by looking at a combination of traits rather than just one trait, one measurement, or one individual. This fact has caused liberals, this failure of statistics and measurements, according to him, has caused liberals and other materialists to deny that race exists. This incredible doctrine came from America. I have to stop right here and say, you know, this is Boas. This is Franz Boas and a bunch of other Jews. Ashley Montague is another, and useful idiots that they surrounded themselves with, and the pseudoscience that they did to perpetrate this fraud. They're the ones who denied that race exists. And they didn't actually start by denying that race exists. They denied that race was significant, that there was any significance to it. They did it in a very tricky way, like a wedge. They started with the idea that, oh, it's just skin color and kinky hair versus straight hair, other surface things, but it's below the skin. We're all like the same, except we're not. The blood types are different. The skeletons are different. The diseases are different. I've been over this topic before, and their work was a fraud, and for Yaki, unfortunately, is basing his argument here, his logic, on their fraud, taking it as fact. This doctrine really only amounts, race denial, only amounts to a confession of total inability of rationalism and scientific method to understand race or subject it to order of the type of the physical sciences. And this inability was known before by those who have clung to facts and resisted anti-factual theories. He's actually inverting the reality there. As I said, it's the anti-racism and denial of race, the significance of race, comes from the Jews. They derailed the race science that was actually ongoing at the time, that was actually starting to get at what the nature of race was. It was European white men who were doing that race science, and it was Jews who derailed it and put an end to it. And the story is a long story, and it took place over decades, but World War II was right at the center of it all. He goes on here to talk about the Hollywood type and racial beauty. He says this instinct for racial beauty, needless to say, has no connection with the decadent erotic cults of the Hollywood type. Such ideals are purely individual, intellectual, and have no connection with race. Race being an expression, and this, he, says something I think is true here. Race being an expression of the cosmic, not that part, is informed throughout with the urge to continuity. And a racially ideal woman is always thought of quite unconsciously as the potential mother of strong sons. The racial ideal man is the master who will enrich the life of the woman who secures him as the father of her children. That I think is very true, that the way that the two sexes idealize the other sex. The degenerate eroticism of the Hollywood type is anti-racial. Its root idea and not life continuity, but pleasure is not life continuity, but pleasure, with the woman as the object of pleasure and the man as the slave of this object. He doesn't make the connection here that the Hollywood type is promulgated by Jews. The same Jews are promulgating this, what he calls an anti-racial idea, as the Jews who were promulgating literal anti-race science, pseudoscience. Not to say that they were necessarily in contact with each other and planning this, conspiring to do this, but they had basically, in both cases, the same idea in mind. It's not good for the Jews that the Goyim start to understand this idea of race, because understanding race and the importance of heritage and biological continuity, if you can figure that out, you figure out the Jews. And it's the first step toward racial consciousness, is being aware of how it works. What's going on? This brings us to the most important phase of the objective meaning of race in this age. History narrows or widens the limits of race determinacy. The way this is done is through the spiritual element in race. Thus, a group with spiritual and historical community tends to acquire also a racial aspect. A little further on, he writes, an important example of this is the creation of the Jewish race that we now know in the millennium of the ghetto existence in Europe. This is what, in the very first part of the Yockian liberalism series, many, many installments ago now, I talked about the criticism that Revolo Oliver had of Yockey. And this is one of the main points that he criticized, was this idea that Yockey seemed to have, that the Jews didn't come into existence until about 1,000 years ago in the ghettos of medieval Europe. And let me just read that little bit that Oliver wrote. He wrote, the most tragic example of, when Yockey concluded that the Jewish race, in his non-biological sense of the word, was formed by the ghettos of medieval Europe, he probably did not know that the historical record extends over 25 centuries. There is no reason to suppose that the Jews who migrated to the medieval cities and established their ghettos aroused more resentment among the Christian populations than the Jews who settled on an island in the Nile River, in the Nile near the first cataract, aroused among the native Egyptian population in the 5th century BC. Well, actually, I do think Yockey was aware that the Jews had a longer history. He had written earlier on page 169, the most tragic example of culture parasitism for the West has been the presence of a part of a nation from the Arabian culture scattered through the entire body of the West. So there it seems like he did understand that the Jews came from outside of Europe and from before the medieval time. And I've got some more to say about Oliver and a little bit more on Yockey and race, and then I think we'll be done with Yockey.